from Oklahoma to Ohio, North Dakota to Georgia, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, despite the president's efforts to put a positive spin on the term Bidenomics, Americans are not buying it. Vance Ginn, former chief economist at the Office of Management and Budget, is here to explain why. Donald Trump emerged the clear winner on Super Tuesday, and this has set up a general election rematch between him and President Biden. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. High interest rates are the vibe that is creating the gravitational pull, causing Americans to have a dismal view of the U.S. economy. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And International Women's Day has its roots in Marxist-Communist ideology and is now celebrated by those unaware of its origins. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Joe Biden touts what he views as his administration's economic accomplishments, but at the kitchen table, families are still feeling the pain. Vance Ginn served as chief economist at the Office of Management and Budget. He's currently host of the Let People Prosper podcast and is president of Ginn Economic Consulting. He joins us now to discuss why the nation remains in the economic doldrums. Vance, welcome to American Radio Journal. Vance, President Biden has been trying to spin the term Bidenomics as a positive term at the State of the Union, of course, touting the what he sees as accomplishments economically of his administration. Is that what people, though, at the kitchen table are actually seeing?
It's a pleasure to be with you, first of all. And no, that's not what Americans are seeing. In fact, Americans can't afford Bidenomics. We've seen what the results are of big government spending, higher taxes, higher regulations, going after every merger or deal through antitrust policy. What it's done is it's driven more uncertainty, and the costs of doing business and having economic activity has increased dramatically. And so now we saw inflation that's been soaring. If you go back since January 2021, when Biden came into office, and you take average weekly earnings, which have been growing over time, but you adjust them for CPI inflation, they're down. Those average weekly earnings are down inflation-adjusted dollars by 4.4%. So what does that mean? That means that that same dollar that you were making just January 2021, 3 years ago, is buying you 4.4% less than what you could then. And this has hurt families across the country. So Biden loves to tout Bidenomics, but Americans can't stand it. And in fact, they can't afford it.
The Biden administration, of course, is pushing all manner of additional spending here, aid for Ukraine, aid for Israel, and numerous other big spending proposals. Can you tell us a little bit, what impact does all this government spending, particularly since it's deficit spending, how does that relate to inflation?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think many people would say, well, there's not a connection. Deficits don't matter. But I think we've seen, we know what we've seen in the last couple of years is a direct consequence of those actions. So how do they deal with this? When the government runs a budget deficit, which has been around $2 trillion and looks to be $2 trillion per year for the foreseeable future, they have a couple of ways you can pay for this. Well, you could pay for it through raising taxes dramatically, which they haven't done. You could cut spending dramatically. Well, they haven't done that either. So what they do is they issue bonds, treasury securities, what it's called. The United States Treasury issues these bonds that are purchased out in the economy. And so it's paid for through debt. That's all the bond is a debt. But there are other things that the Treasury can do, right? So when they issue those bonds, that puts upward pressure on interest rates, which is not good for Americans. So we see higher interest rates. Well, then the Federal Reserve, which is the central bank of the United States, says, you know what? That interest rate that's being set in the market is too high. We want to target a lower interest rate. What do? They print money. They buy some of those treasury securities out of the private market, put more money into the economy. And when you have too much money chasing too few goods because of all the higher taxes and regulations that have been put in place by the Biden administration, you get inflation. So we have seen the direct results of the increase in debt, not only from higher interest rates, which mortgage rates are going over 7% now. They were around 3% just a couple of years ago. And we've also seen higher inflation. So these are the direct results of the bad policies from so-called Bidenomics.
You mentioned the word regulation. What impact does all the regulations that we see coming out of Washington these days, Vanson? They even want to regulate things like dishwashers and our lawnmowers. What impact does all this overregulation have on the economy?
Well, it's ridiculous, to your point, whenever you're thinking about dishwashers and everything else. But there's a lot more regulations that the executive branch, the president, has control over. And this administration has used that to the extreme. I worked in the Office of Management and Budget in the Trump White House for a year, and that is where OIRA, which is the regulatory body of the executive branch for the president, we did a lot of the analysis on regulations. And in fact, in the Trump administration, we were able to cut 7 regulations for every new one that was added. So basically, if you look at the first 3 years, there was basically flat in a regulatory cost increase. Compare that now to the Biden administration in the first 3 years. It's been over $400 billion with a B, additional increases in cost across the economy. So while they may not necessarily be jacking up raising taxes dramatically, which they have raised some taxes, they are increasing the cost to all of us through their higher regulations. Regulations really act like a tax. You don't see it directly. It's hidden from us, but it's underlying all the things that we buy on a daily basis. So it's not only the dishwasher, but it's also regulations that have to do with the emission standards for cars. The CAFE standards is what they call them. Well, that raises the price for cars because of the increased cost of producing those cars based on those regulations. And those are just a couple that we're mentioning now, but there are many more that influence our everyday lives.
We are now past Super Tuesday, and obviously former President Donald Trump is going to be the Republican nominee, and Joe Biden obviously sticking it out here to run for re-election, Vance. It's a rerun of that. So with all the problems that we have had and the terrible economy that we have endured over the last 3 years, if you were advising Donald Trump, what sort of message would you suggest that he conveyed to the American people so that there's some hope that things would get better under a Trump presidency?
I think the main thing that I would get across is we need a hopeful, bold vision for the future of America. People have lost sight of what that vision is, and I think it's one that needs to be brought back front and center about the American vision, having our republic, having free market capitalism, that is really the path for the future. It's not socialism. It's not a direct democracy. There are certain things that have happened in America, this idea from our founding fathers, that are so important that have made us the richest country in the world. And I hope that that will continue. But if we continue this path on the socialism, the road to serfdom, if you will, hearkening back to Friedrich Hayek, we're going to be in a world of trouble. And we're seeing the trouble that we have today. So where should former President Trump start? He should start by saying, look, we're going to cut government spending. We're spending too much. The budget has been bloated before and even more so during COVID and the lockdowns and everything else. So we've got to get control over our fiscal situation, or it's going to influence the entire economy and slow our growth and have less job creation if we don't do anything now. We also need to focus on making the Trump tax cuts permanent.
We have been talking with Vance Ginn, who is a former chief economist at the Office of Management and Budget, and he's host of the very popular podcast, Let People Prosper, also president of Ginn Economic Consultants. Vance, tell us a little bit about your podcast, and also where can folks go to listen?
Let People Prosper show have a great discussion with a lot of other people who are experts in certain areas. We talk a lot about how to get government out of the way. What are the impediments that are put in place for people, many of them being government? And so what can we do about that? So I have a Let People Prosper show on Mondays, and on Fridays I have This Week's Economy that are all under the same podcast name of Let People Prosper. You can find all this information on any of your podcast platforms that are out there, but also you can go to vanceginn.com where I have my newsletter and other information where you can get all the key economic insights from a free market perspective.
Vance Ginn. Vance, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. It was Super Tuesday this past week, State of the Union this past week, one of the most important weeks on the political calendar of 2024. We're going to talk about all of that with Scott Parkinson. Scott, good to have you here.
Thank you, Loman.
It now is certain that we are going to have a general election rematch between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, with Nikki Haley dropping out. Want to give us your analysis of the Super Tuesday vote?
Well, it's certain as long as the Democratic National Committee doesn't get rid of him at the convention, but it does look like we're headed for a big rematch of the 2020 election between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. This week, Nikki Haley decided to end her presidential campaign on Wednesday after suffering a pretty massive landslide defeat on the Super Tuesday elections. She did win, I think, in Vermont, but if you're a Vermont Republican, you're probably just to the right of somebody like Bernie Sanders. And really what you saw here was President Trump flexing his muscle all across those Super Tuesday states, including in my Commonwealth of Virginia, where he finished with over 66% of the vote. Some people will say, oh, there's still like a large number of Republicans that aren't getting on board with Donald Trump. And what I would tell those folks is I was out there campaigning on Tuesday night, and there was a woman that came by, and we start talking to her, and she says, I'm quoting her, "I'm a lifelong Democrat, and I just voted for Nikki Haley." And the point is that in a lot of these states, you've got what are known as open primaries, where it's not just limited to registered Republicans that can show up and vote in the primary season. You can be an independent, you can be a Democrat, you just have to be a registered voter, and that's how Virginia handles our elections. So I think that when you see Nikki Haley putting up 33%, when you see her putting up sizable numbers in her home state of South Carolina, the exit polling was clear that Democrats were voting in the Republican primary rather than just keeping this to a party system where we select our nominee as Republicans. What are the ramifications here of Super Tuesday? Listen, Donald Trump is as strong as he's been since he declared his intent to seek the nomination. I think that we are finally at the point where we are unifying all the Republicans of all the different tribes. This week, we even saw two big endorsements for Donald Trump, despite Nikki Haley not endorsing yet. But we did see Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader from Kentucky, and we also saw Governor Glenn Youngkin from Virginia come out in support of Donald Trump and say it's time to unite the party. So I think that's a positive development. I hope that we can all have the same common opponent and Joe Biden, and really turn the page on Bidenomics and this illegal alien crisis that's caused by the Biden open borders.
Isn't all this really fairly normal here, Scott, for those of us who have been involved in elections for, well, decades now, that you have primaries, you have candidates compete for their party nominations? Obviously, nobody gets 100% or even 90% in a primary process, but then you have a coming together after the primary election and over the summer. So what's occurring in the Republican Party? Isn't this just normal for campaigns?
It's pretty normal. I think the anomaly here is that Donald Trump is a former president. And as he has this incredibly strong base of support among America First and MAGA, that gave him a sizable advantage in what was termed as an open primary. But he was always a front runner, even before he announced. And as he moved through the primary season, his support has solidified. And I think that that's what's common here, is that we did have opponents that trickled out. Many didn't even make it to Iowa. And ultimately, Trump is in a very, very strong position, winning all the swing states, including Pennsylvania right now. I think if the election was today, Donald Trump would finish above 320 electoral votes.
Also this past week, President Joe Biden got to deliver his State of the Union address until the Democrat National Convention, arguably the biggest platform he's going to have. With his approval numbers, his job approval numbers so low and even lower among the key issues, immigration, the economy, et cetera, is it even possible now for Biden to do a reset for the general election?
Another great question. When I look at Joe Biden and the State of the Union, the Biden White House was proclaiming all this energy from Joe Biden and how he was going to be talking about taxing the rich and how he was going to be talking about reproductive rights for women and trying to continue the IVF messaging that they've got. Well, the reality is that the Democratic talking points are incredibly stale. And what they're not doing is addressing the key issues that matter to the American people. This is why independents are leaving Joe Biden in large numbers. And I think that people are incredibly concerned about the cost of living. And taxing the rich is not a solution for decreasing the cost of energy and decreasing the cost of food, where it's $6 for a bag of potato chips. I think that the Biden administration is trying to run a campaign based off poll testing, but we know that there's all the push polls that you can try to manufacture is not going to change the fact that they have a candidate who has lost many, many steps since he was campaigning from his basement in 2020.
Just with a minute or so we have remaining here, up on Capitol Hill, again, major activity this past week. The House and Senate are both trying to get to a federal budget. We're still, again, on a continuing resolution. A little bit of movement on that this week in the House?
Yeah, the House passed their minibus. It was six of the 12 subcommittees and appropriations. Listen, this was a big swamp deal, in my opinion. Club for Growth came out opposed to that. And we also need to make sure that as we oppose these appropriation battles, that we're prepared for the next fight, which will ultimately happen after September. And what I would predict, and you know, we can mark the calendar today here in early March, but what they're going to do is another continuing resolution in September that puts us in the lame duck and tries to clear the deck for Donald Trump and his presidency.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, give us a little bit of background on the club.
Well, Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. Check out clubforgrowth.org to see what we're up to. And join, become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll look forward to talking with you next week. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Interest rates are at a 20-year high, putting major purchases like home ownership or buying a new car out of reach for many American households. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine discusses the impact.
We're going to talk, as we normally do, about economics and politics today, but first, let's talk a little bit about astronomy. See, back in the mid-1840s, astronomers noticed a strange wobble in the path of the planet Uranus as it was revolving around the sun. Some of them theorized that that wobble could only be caused by another large gravitational field pulling on Uranus, another planet, one that we didn't know about at the time. So those scientists did a bunch of complex math. They applied Isaac Newton's theories of gravity, and they pointed their telescopes at the spot in the sky where the missing planet was supposed to be, and boom, that's how humans confirmed the existence of Neptune. For political economists, 2024 is now the mid-1840s, and President Joe Biden's approval ratings and voters' opinions about the state of the economy might as well be the orbit of Uranus around the sun. Those things aren't behaving the way they're supposed to. There's an unexpected wobble. And because of how the gravitational pull of that mystery planet could affect the 2024 presidential election, it's likely to be one of the biggest stories of the year. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. Unemployment is low and inflation is falling, but consumer sentiment remains depressed. And that series of events has confounded economists, who historically rely on those two variables to gauge how consumers feel about the economy. That's the opening line of a new paper co-authored by Harvard economist Larry Summers, along with three other economists. Summers sets out to solve that conundrum. And I think it's a fascinating one for us to consider. By the traditional view, Americans should be pretty thrilled about the state of the economy right now. Inflation, yes, remains higher than normal, but it has come down considerably since peaking in the summer of 2022. Wages have now consistently outpaced inflation every month since last May, nearly a full year ago. And the so-called soft landing from inflation seems to have been achieved without tipping the economy into recession. Low unemployment means that workers have considerable leverage to seek raises and better jobs, and they can take refuge in the knowledge that finding another job will be relatively easy if they do get laid off. And yet, most Americans remain pretty sour about the state of the economy. According to a Gallup poll last month, 45% of Americans rate the country's economic conditions as poor, a far larger share than those who rate it as excellent, that's 5%, or good, that's 22%. As bleak as those figures are, that's actually a slight improvement over similar Gallup polls from late 2023. Unsurprisingly, since many people vote with their wallets, Biden's approval ratings and scores on questions about his handling of the economy, with the usual caveats that presidents don't actually control these things, well, those ratings all remain well underwater. So what's up? Where's the mystery planet that's tugging on Americans' view of what would appear to be a strong, growing economy? The four authors of that paper point their metaphorical telescopes at interest rates. Because the cost of borrowing money, they explain, is not currently included in traditional price indexes, indicating a disconnect between the measures favored by economists and the effective costs that are borne by consumers. Here's what that means. With inflation rates hitting 20-year highs in the wake of the pandemic, everything from mortgage payments to car payments to the interest costs on credit cards have shot upwards, and that is undeniably putting a drain on Americans' wallets. For Summers and the rest, this explains the significant portion of what some analysts have referred to as the vibe session, the vague but persistent sense that things just aren't going as well as they should be. As a practical matter, the economists suggest that interest rates should be taken into account when measuring things like consumer sentiment about the economy. The inclusion of borrowing costs, they write, into an alternative measure of CPI inflation significantly narrows the gap between predicted and actual consumer sentiment. More generally, I think this theory probably explains a lot. The sticker shock of higher prices at the grocery store might have kind of waned a bit, but higher interest rates impact Americans in lots of ways that aren't really that obvious. In 2018, the average monthly car payment on a new car was about $500. Last year, it was over $700. Some of that increase is due to inflation in the price of the vehicle, sure, but a sizable chunk of it is due to the fact that interest rates are a lot higher now than they were a few years ago, and an extra $200 a month is a lot. It might cause some Americans to put off a planned purchase of a new car in the hopes that rates will fall. I mean, heck, I've done that. Or it might feel like such a purchase is just completely unaffordable and out of the question. In short, the vibe session is not just a reflection of how inflation has sapped the buying power of the dollars in your wallet. It's that higher interest rates triggered by inflation have made it more expensive to obtain the necessary dollars to make big purchases, to buy the stuff that you can't afford to buy with the money in your wallet. Americans feel, correctly, that those big things are now farther out of reach, and they might feel more burdened by routine things too, like the costs of their credit card purchases. I think there's another factor at work here too. Interest rates have been remarkably low for a long time until the past few years. Anyone younger than Gen X has never dealt with mortgage rates or loan rates approaching their current levels. Mortgage rates remain well below where they were when my parents were buying their first home in the early 1980s. The interest rate on that purchase was something like 18%, but that is utterly meaningless to people like me or anyone younger than me who have seen mortgage rates nearly triple since 2020. Chalk all of that up to another reason why inflation is such a dangerous beast to turn loose and why those encouraging Biden to run the economy hot were playing with fire. Long after price hikes have slowed, the costs of the recent inflationary run are still being felt. The vibes created by higher interest rates, it turns out, are a bit like gravity. They're easily felt, but more difficult to measure. It's an invisible force, one that's best observed by recognizing the consequences it exerts on other things like nearby planets and presidential approval ratings. And if used correctly, you might point your gaze towards a missing piece of the economic political picture. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more of our coverage of everything going on in the economy and in politics in the country at Reason.com. Also, our coverage of the State of the Union address, which is going to be happening a few hours after I record this. So we'll cover that next week when you can catch me right back here on another edition of American Radio Journal.
If you celebrate International Women's Day, you should know that you are celebrating an event with Marxist communist roots. We learn more from Dr. Paul Kengor of the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College on this American Radio Journal commentary.
In April 1845, Karl Marx's mother-in-law sent to the Marx family a nanny named Helen DeMuth, known as Lenchen. Marx's long-suffering wife, Jenny, was thrilled. After all, both Jenny and Marx's own mother expressed the wish that Karl would, quote, earn some capital rather than just writing about capital, unquote. But Karl refused to earn capital. In fact, he refused to work altogether. So when Jenny's mom sent Lenchen, the nursemaid, Marx's wife breathed a big sigh of relief. Then again, it isn't quite right to say that Lenchen worked for Karl's family, given that she toiled without pay. Karl Marx, champion of the proletariat and the working class, never paid Lenchen a penny. The poor girl gave everything to the Marx household. She even gave her body to Karl. literally. Karl bedded Lenchen behind his wife Jenny's back. Historians have no idea how often, including whether the sex was consensual. But in due course, a child was born. Lenchen gave birth to a baby boy. Karl Marx refused to concede that the little boy was his, and naturally refused even a penny of child support. Of course, Marx's devoted but despairing wife, Jenny, was surely not surprised by this. I revisit this sordid history here because of the sordid event that our perverse American culture now strangely commemorates. It's something called International Women's Day. What Karl Marx did to Lenchen is a metaphor for what communism has done to billions of human beings and how Karl Marx viewed women. It's also an appropriate omen for International Women's Day, which has long been a communist holiday. Yes, correct. And if you're shocked and outraged at what I just said about your new holiday, well, you have my sympathy because you're a victim too. That is, of this country's horrific schools. Our sadly ignorant modern Americans celebrating this annual day don't even know its Marxist origins. Now, for me personally, the day has now become my unfortunate custom to write on International Women's Day every March when the wretched thing rears its ugly head. And it rears it mightily. Google, the world's dominant search engine, underscores the day immediately every March 8th as the clock strikes 12:01 a.m. The masses respond in kind, thinking that they should do the same. But sadly, those now suddenly celebrating International Women's Day are utterly oblivious to its socialist origins. When I try to inform them that they're commemorating a day that the Bolsheviks literally championed, they either give me a blank stare or a glare. In friendlier cases, they'll object to me with something incredulous like, "Well, so what? It isn't a Marxist or communist or socialist holiday today, at least not for me." Well, okay. Indeed, for most people celebrating the day today, it is not. Though, by the way, for many others, it is. We in America and in the wider West have long had a major problem with the wider liberal left and culture at large cluelessly signing up for various causes and campaigns launched by Marxists. In fact, it's telling that the longest book that I ever wrote was titled Dupes. As for International Women's Day, it's another example of just that. Just as American communists in the old days were able to sucker wider swaths of the American public into their various front groups simply by giving them names like the American Peace Mobilization or the American League Against War and Fascism, so they've done with events with names like International Women's Day. But if you need any evidence of that, then simply go to the websites of groups like Communist Party USA, Marxist.org, or People's World. Yes, I'm telling you, go there. Go. Please go. Look at how they mark International Women's Day. Go to your computer, type in International Women's Day, type in People's World, type in Marxist.org. Look and learn. It's all there. You have no excuse for not knowing better. I'm telling you, I know. And if you're still willing to celebrate it after all of that, then you're what the communists used to call a sucker. I'll close with this provocative question. What do Vladimir Putin and International Women's Day have in common? Answer, they were both promoted by the KGB. Yes, no exaggeration. Doesn't that bother you? It should. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengore. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WSKY-AM in Asheville, North Carolina, WFAM-AM in Augusta, Georgia, along with WBXR-AM in Huntsville, Alabama. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.